You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel.
Coming up this week in episode 269, we look at the scandals that brought down Anthony Weiner and we wonder if the Trump campaign can reach any lower depths. The Olympic Games. Has the first week been pure gold or has it wheezed home in last place? And we'll tell you if Paul Morley's new book captures the essence and spirit of Palmer of David Bowie. That's all coming right up after the new single from The Wonder Stuff.
I love that. For 30 years now, Myles Hunt has consistently constructed great pop songs with catchy melodies. This is the latest. It's the new single from The Wonder Stuff for the brokenhearted. Welcome to the Parish Council podcast. It's episode 269, brought to you by the Media Motel. I'm Terence Stackham, and here's our Wonder Woman. It's Juliet Harris.
Oh, that is very kind. Thank you very much. Good morning.
Jules, good morning. Jules, earlier this week, I watched a documentary movie about a man who absolutely fascinates me. He's a man who's made appearances on archive editions of this podcast. He's Anthony Weiner. Anthony, pronounced the New York way, like in The Sopranos. Mm. The movie is on limited release over here, but if anyone's got an interest in the way American politics works, it's enormously revealing and well worth going to see. His political career crashed after what has been called sexting scandals in the USA. He was a member of Congress when he sent explicit photos of himself to a woman via his public Twitter account. Mm. It all came out, so to speak, and he resigned from Congress. Now, 2 years later, in 2013, He decided to run for mayor of New York City. You know, I put all the past behind me, all that sort of thing. All was going great. He was doing superbly in the polls. He was leading in the polls. But then he sent more explicit pictures to another woman. In the Democratic primary, he ended up, he polled less than 5% in the election. All of this is complicated by the fact that he's married to Huma Abedin. She's a high-ranking political staffer for Hillary Clinton. And in the movie, we see in excruciating detail how she tries to balance supporting her husband whilst clearly being put under pressure to ensure the publicity doesn't get dragged over into Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. There seems to be huge differences between US and British politics and the way so-called scandals are reported on the two bookends of the Atlantic. It's quite intriguing. Wiener's career seems to be over. Do you think he'd be treated the same way over here?
Well, isn't that interesting? Yeah, I was having a look earlier at the sort of the details of all of this. I think I would say that, well, firstly, the details in this are a bit entertaining. In the so that the second scandal that he then got involved in 2013, he was sending explicit photos of himself under the alias Carlos Danger,
which is a
heck of a name, isn't it? It sounds like a sort of a comic book. And it turns out that the 22-year-old woman that he'd been sending messages to was called Sydney Leathers.
I know. So you couldn't make it up, could you?
It all sounds made up, doesn't it? But it's interesting. I was digging back through his past, actually, to think about why perhaps he was hung out to dry. And I'll read this from the Wikipedia entry. In July 2008, the New York Times characterised Wiener as one of the most intense and demanding of bosses, describing him as often working long hours with his staff, requiring them to be in constant contact by BlackBerry, frequently yelling at them, and occasionally throwing office furniture in anger. As a result, according to the Times, he had one of the highest staff turnover rates of any member of Congress, including at one point three chiefs of staff in 18 months.
This comes over in the movie, Jules. You've seen moments of it, because it's a sort of fly on the wall. The documentary team follow him, you know, comprehensively over a year or two. And you do see moments where he absolutely loses it badly.
And in order to answer the question, would he be treated differently over here? I'm sort of looking in my own mind about why he was treated the way he was over there. And it's funny. I think there are probably more politicians and people in public life that behave in this way than we know. Maybe it's the ones that aren't very nice that end up, if you pardon the pun, getting exposed by people around them, because maybe, you know, if you're not very nice on the way up, then you know, you might not be getting a lot of help on the way back down. So I wonder if the ones that we do learn about in terms of scandals, we learn about because they've just upset everybody around them, and then they've ended up being found out. I don't know. In terms of how he'd be treated over here, yeah, I tend to find, although, you know, everyone's very concerned about the rise of Donald Trump, political discourse does seem to be less grown up over here than it seems to be in the States. And it's almost a kind of a sort of a carry-on type sort of judgment to it, I think. Although, having said that, I remember, obviously, that in terms of sort of large sort of en masse scandals, we had to look back to John Major's notorious Back to Basics campaign that became derailed in the 90s. I mean, just reading through that Wikipedia is pretty mind-boggling. But then sort of sexual scandals were only one arm of that, weren't there? There was all sorts of different you know, sort of sleaze type things involved. The last kind of scandal we've had over here, and actually we all missed it in a way, and I don't know if we missed it because it's not seen as being so serious, or if we missed it because of what was going on. You may recall in the middle of, so when the Tory leadership campaign kind of opened up after Miss Cameron stood down, we knew that Theresa May was running, and we knew that Boris Johnson, well, we thought Boris Johnson was running, and he wasn't, but the final five we ended up with was Liam Fox, Andrea Leadsom, Theresa May, there was, who's the other one? Michael Gove and Stephen Crabbe. And Stephen Crabbe was seen as quite a...
I'd forgotten him already.
Absolutely. Well, that says it all, doesn't it? But he was seen as kind of a sort of a... I found him quite an interesting figure, actually. He came from a working-class background in Wales, and was seen as perhaps one of the quote-unquote new Tories. If they were going to stick with the Cameron Osborne approach to things, he was DWP. He might be worth, you know, he was seen as being quite young and quite articulate. And, you know, it was thought he perhaps wouldn't win, but a good campaign might have placed him in good stead for the future. On the morning that the story broke in the Times about Andrea Leadsom's ill-judged comments about Theresa May not being a mother, which was the front page splash that, that Rachel Sylvester wrote for the Times, there was a sidebar on the front page. And Stephen Crabbe had always made a great virtue of the fact that he was married with two youngish children, I think, is very profoundly Christian. And is, you know, very much one of these family values types. And he had apparently been messaging a much younger woman over sending sort of fairly intimate, what we care. It seemed that they started off being friends, and he used to text her, got WhatsApp, I think, was used quite frequently. And then towards the end, it took a rather more lurid kind of turn. And he, and you know, this was found out and reported on. But because of everything else that was going on at the time, it was the fortnight of constant news. It rather flew under the radar.
He didn't
pull out of the leadership race, but he then... sort of said, oh, he wouldn't stand in the cabinet because he needed to spend time with his family. And we haven't heard much of him since. So his wife is employed as his office kind of manager, I think. And I'm trying to unpack in my own mind why it flew under the radar as much as it did. Did it fly under the radar because there was so much else going on that it really was the least of everyone's problems? Did it fly under the radar because, and I am going to make a slightly sort of shouty feminist point here, there's a bit of a boys will be boys attitude sometimes. I don't know if it was that, maybe. Maybe in this modern day and age it was seen as less scandalous. I don't know. But the ironic thing was is that when he was talking to this woman over, it would seem a number of years actually, sort of messaging, initially they were just sort of friendly in there. She was a staffer, I think, who had some interest in politics. And he was actually commenting on the case of Brooke Newmark, who was a politician, who is a Conservative MP, who had got caught sending pictures of himself to some random woman who was not his wife. And Stephen Crabbe was talking about Brooke Newmark and saying, oh, you know, it can be really stressful and it can be, you know, quite a lonely existence as an MP. And it was also people get these kind of sort of ideas of power. And he was kind of quite critical of Brooke Newmark. And then a couple of years later fell into exactly the same trap. So as his profile rose, perhaps. I don't know if it was a vanity thing. I don't know why it's not treated as seriously over here. I think it's treated seriously. That thinking back to basics, the John Major and that series of scandals, I think that things are treated as part of a narrative in British politics, in the media. And I think if, like all things, my dad always has this saying that if there's a house fire, the house fire happens, there will be four house fires reported in the newspaper next week. There were four house fires last week, but because they are more newsworthy, they're now reported more. So I don't know if that thing comes into play.
And
it's, you know, contextually, there has to be a sort of a move in that direction. I don't know, but you're right, they are treated differently, and I can't work out why.
Also in America this week, Donald Trump, of course, said that President Obama was responsible for the formation of Islamic State, Daesh, and also made a bizarre remark at a campaign rally in which he said the US Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, might be used to stop Hillary Clinton. Eventually, he said he was being sarcastic, he was joking. But even if he was joking, this is really in questionable taste. This is a new low, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's just appalling, really. And it's interesting now. About 2 weeks ago, I was genuinely concerned that Donald Trump was making inroads, and I think a lot of commentators were. It seems to have become even, I don't know, he seems to have hit, like you say, hit new heights, or rather new lows of poor taste, that I think there are lots of, there's talk of an intervention amongst the Republicans now, because he seems to be behaving in a way that is, well, I mean, lots of people dismiss him as being mad or having mental health issues, which actually all that does is tar people that have mental health issues, in my view. I don't think that's a very responsible way to talk about it. But certainly,
it could be true, though, Jules. Sorry to interrupt you, but I know exactly what you mean. But the fact is that he does give the impression of someone with severe issues.
He's very unbalanced, isn't he? Which is, yeah, I agree. And yes, okay. But I mean, it's or the alternative is he's just really unpleasant. There is that, or possibly both. You know, you can be both. But I just think, and actually now we've hit that stage where apparently Mrs. Clinton is leading in very unexpected states to the point where the Democrats are now actually pumping quite a lot of resources into seats that have been traditionally quote unquote safe, not seats, states, sorry, that have been traditionally Republican. Quote unquote Republican areas, because I think they think they can beat him very easily now. Now it certainly seems that when you compare Donald Trump's increasingly out there comments with Hillary Clinton, who's just done the same thing throughout, basically, there's almost parallels with Theresa May again here, isn't it? She's just doing what she does and just getting on with it and letting everybody else make their own mistakes. But yeah, I agree. It was to imply that, you know, someone should use gun violence against your opponent, other people should use gun violence against your opponent, is, well, that aspect of it I find extremely cowardly. But it's just horrible, really. And I was particularly noted the comments of Gabrielle Giffords, the senator.
Yes, who got shot, yes.
Yeah, and she, yeah, I mean, you know, how must she feel about it? And equally, you know, Joe Cox over here, who was killed a few weeks ago. It's, you know, extraordinarily irresponsible, and it's someone that has a tin ear for the world, I think, really, and I find that very, very disturbing. I hope that the general feeling in the media that Mrs. Clinton is now pulling away and building up a lead are really true, because the thought of, I mean, and also the reports a week or so ago that Donald Trump had asked about nuclear weapons and how, you know, the use of nuclear weapons, not once, not twice, but three times. You know, I'd sincerely hope that this chap is now coming across badly enough to enough people in America that you know, people are frightened and think he's a security risk. And that's usually the way in which you stop people. And if, you know, Jeremy Corbyn wins the Labour leadership again, which I don't think is cut and dried as everybody thinks it is, but I suspect that he might, then the way in which the Tories will completely eviscerate Labour, you know, the brutality that we'll see in the press will be like nothing anybody's ever experienced before. It will make Ed Miliband's bacon sandwich look like a walk in the park. They will go for national security. That will be the line. Well, you know, I'm sure there are filing cabinets full of Jeremy Corbyn meeting Hamas and you know, the IRA and all kinds of things building up at Conservative HQ as we speak. And that's, you know, to be seen as a threat to national security is beyond the pale. If people don't take you seriously on national security, they will not have any interest in listening to anything you've got to say on anything else. So I wonder if, you know, yes, I don't agree with Donald Trump's comments at all. I think they were irresponsible and unpleasant. And as you say, another level of unpleasant. But I hope that will waver us up, really.
Yeah. Okay, well, this has been the first week of the Olympic Games. If you've been watching it in the UK, you'll have needed your remote control in your hand as a permanent fixture, as the BBC inexplicably moves coverage between channels every half hour. It's absolutely infuriating. You're just sort of settling down the sofa and they go, well, to continue watching coverage of the judo, you'll need to retune to BBC Two. And then after about another 30 minutes, well, the equestrian coverage continues now on BBC One. You go, oh, God! And you're looking for your high-definition channels on your remote. Anyway, that's all coming up, looking at the Olympics, week one, right after this soul classic from 1974.
Everybody get funky.
Bow, huh?
That was the incredibly fine. I heard this recently, and I always get stuck on how many agains to put in the title. But I think the full title is genuine. This is Lynn Collins, the singer, and the title of it is genuinely Rock Me Again and Again and Again and Again and Again and Again, I think is actually the full title of that record. How they printed it on the original label, I don't know. But yes, there are six agains in that. So it comes from the excellently titled album Check Me Out If You Don't Know Me By Now, which is sort of it pleasingly kind of boastful and self-effacing at the same time, isn't it, really? So,
I first came across that track. It was covered by the Human League on their Hysteria album. Yeah, that's where I first heard it. But there's the original.
1975 was the year that came out.
As we record this, we're at the end of the first week of the 2016 Olympic Games. And I'm not sure what it is, the time difference, the fact that it's not London. But I felt a bit kind of meh about this first week, maybe until the last day or so, Bradley Wiggins cycling gold and some rowing people and so on. But I know I've got a bit of a reputation for being something of a moaning mini about the way...
I was going to say curmudgeon to make
curmudgeon
it sound a bit mannier,
I'll take that as well. Yeah, the way TV... Well, generally, I'm a curmudgeon and a moaning mini, but the way TV covers many sports, I felt a kind of renewed sense of teeth-grinding, cringe-inducing despair. This week, the way the BBC has felt compelled to... it's every single British competitor that have been covered, radio and TV, BBC, compelled to introduce a human interest backstory to every British sporting endeavour at the Olympics. Last week, we've had cameras in the home of the grandmother of a swimmer, she's watching her react to her son's gold medal. We have to know some minor detail about the families of any British competitor, provided it has to fit into some sort of Davina McCall long-lost family narrative or has a sort of depth. It's a kind of story. They're looking for backstories that would appeal to the readers of those kind of 50 pence magazines that we seem to have.
Take a break.
That's it. You know, the kind of Katie Price, Nadia, Claudia Winkleman on the cover kind of magazines. Mm. Maybe, though, Jules, you've been enjoying the games of the 33rd Olympiad more than me.
Well, yes, I'd agree. There is something a little bit... It did start off feeling a bit flat. I mean, I don't want to fall into the kind of Western privileged kind of laughing at developing and upcoming countries, but I have to say parts of the organisation appear to be rather shambolic. There was a talk on the radio, I think it was on the TV actually, on Breakfast TV, about ticketing.
Mm.
And I mean, apparently the athletic stadium was about 15% full last night.
It was. I saw it. It was
just
extraordinary.
Horrendous, yeah. Isn't it? And they seem to have got the ticket pricing completely wrong. There was someone complaining on TV that some of the tickets for some of the events were 80% of the monthly average wage for a sort of a working person. So hence why, you know, the ticket sales have struggled. And because of Brazil and it being where it is, I don't think it's quite as attractive to our sort of corporate friends, is it, really? I mean, remember when there was a massive hoo-ha at London about how people had, you know, they've been oversubscribed phone lines to get Olympic tickets and all that kind of stuff. And some of the corporate box areas were completely empty and there was a big sort of fuss about it. That doesn't, you know, everywhere seems to be empty in Brazil. Yeah. That doesn't help the atmosphere. The peculiar things like the odd case of the green pool in the diving, that was rather unnerving, I think, as well, which is now apparently
very
been closed,
peculiar, yeah.
They can't seem to work out they don't seem to be entirely bothered about working out what caused it. And Tom Daley commented on Twitter, It's been closed now. Hopefully none of us caught anything when we were diving in it during the last day and a half. I mean, as far as the British perspective goes, because there is something peculiarly partisan, I think, about being a British person watching the Olympics. I don't know if other countries' coverage of the Olympics are so ridiculously partisan and British-focused as ours are. But at first, it was the festival of Britain coming fourth and fifth, wasn't it? That seemed to happen for about 2 or 3 days. And my mum said, I'm fed up of watching Britain not win things. And then now there seems to be, you know, we hear the words gold rush, don't we, every time we start to win things. And that seems to be happening now. As ever, we're the sitting down and standing still sports that seems to be that British kind of, that British thing. Anything that involves sitting on a bike, sitting in a rowing boat, standing up and shooting at something.
Sitting on a horse.
Yeah, absolutely. Although, to be fair, the rugby people did get silver. But that's not to deride their achievements at all. They sit down in a far more medal-winning way than I ever could. You're right. There was something about it that wasn't quite catching fire. Although, I don't know now, I suspect. And of course, I think, as you say, London was a special case. There was something about London and it being here that was just, you know, pretty incredible, I think. And certainly when you look at the diversity of the stuff that happened in London 2012, I think there's been a lot of people commenting online that Britain in 2016 feels like a very different, less happy, less united place than it did 4 years ago. Although maybe, who knows, maybe we were just seeing what we wanted to see or papering over the cracks. I don't know. But be interesting to see how Britain get on. Apparently, we are slightly at the perception at first that we weren't doing as well as we were in London. But isn't perception an interesting thing? Because when they compared the figures, we actually were doing slightly better than we had done at London. We were slightly ahead of our total. We've been given a target, the British athletes people, well, then the British kind of Olympic Association or whoever they are, we won 63 medals in London and we have a target of 48 this time. They said that no country that has hosted the Olympics has ever gone on to equal or better their medal total the next year, the next time.
That's,
I think,
interesting.
Like that. So it'd be interesting to see kind of what happens. But I can't help but enjoy the Olympics because I do love the idea. I think the time difference doesn't help. I mean, sitting up until 11 o'clock at night to watch Britain get completely rolled over by Fiji in the rugby final was not necessarily the most rewarding of experiences. But I love the idea that you can pop in. I can come home and there's always some random sport on, isn't there? You can always, and I love learning, and you can always learn new things and suddenly become an expert on technical dismounts or whatever. I think, I enjoy it.
All of that, but just think, the BBC has exclusive rights to the coverage here in the UK. Now, as much as I genuinely do admire Claire Balding and bow before her when it comes to her horse racing knowledge and ability as a horse racing presenter, is there really no one else with the skills to front television shows that encompass a national interest? Royal weddings, state occasions, all your sport. I was thinking, if the planet is ever invaded by aliens, we can be sure it'll be Claire Balding who we send to interview the alien leader, you know, as he or she or it emerges from their super alien spacecraft. Is there nobody else, Jules?
Well, I mean, I think Claire Balding is an absolute class act as a presenter. I think she's so good. And so I can see your point.
Everything.
It's a bit irritating that she does everything. Although, having said that, though, I've seen a lot of Olympics coverage that hasn't had Claire Balding on it. I mean, the swimming, she has not done the swimming in the Olympics. Last time she did the swimming in the Olympics, because we had the Chad's dad thing.
Bert Klurs.
Yes, indeed. And this year when they did the swimming, it was Helen Skelton that was presenting the swimming with Rebecca Adlington and Mark Foster as her kind of talking heads. Where I think it is interesting, and I think actually, if we are going to have the same presenter for most, because I think I seem to remember Olympics in the past where Sue Barker, Hazel Irvin and Claire Balding were sort of on a kind of a rotation schedule. So you would have, I think that might have been Athens, I think you saw them kind of, the three of them seem to be kind of sharing the role of front again, and that doesn't seem to happen now.
She's very good. I mean, I don't want to give the wrong impression. I think she's superb, everything.
But having said that, though, I think that if you are going to have, I can see why the BBC might want continuity in their output. I know that might be a bit of a weak argument, but I'll just put it there. And I can see, if they are going to run one person doing lots of things, it then means that the co-presenters that you end up with are absolutely crucial. And I have to say, I think it would have been Thursday, was it Thursday evening, I think?
Mm-hmm.
They had the cycling, and the kind of the finals of the cycling were really starting, and they had Chris Hoy on as her talking head. And he was excellent.
He was very good.
Really interesting, really pleasant. And but he brought out the best in Claire Balding, because she was very interested in what he had to say. And I had to say, I could have sat and watched the two of them talking about basically anything for a very long time, because they were two people that seemed to work very well together. So actually, I think that Claire Balding's strengths, one of her strengths is that if you do just don't want just all Claire Balding all the time, one of her strengths is actually, and I think she exhibits this on her Ramblings programme on Radio 4 as well, is drawing people out and actually getting interesting. Just because people are interesting doesn't always necessarily mean that they say interesting things. You have to interview them properly to get them to say interesting things. And you know, I'm not as opposed to Claire Balding fronting everything, because I just think she's really good. And having seen a lot of very bad people fronting things over the years, why fix what is not broken?
It could be considerably worse. I accept your point.
How would you deal with a wall-to-wall, I don't know, wall-to-wall Fern Cotton, for example?
Oh, Lord. Okay, I've changed my mind. Keep Claire. Let Claire do everything. Yeah, that's fair enough. This year, Paul Morley has spent 10 weeks writing 150,000 words that comprise his new book, The Age of Bowie. Is it a suitable tribute? We'll tell you after this track from the Ziggy Stardust album. As a teenager in 1972, I think that every party I attended that year, the Ziggy Stardust album found its way onto the host turntable, and that track was usually the one that got everybody up and jumping about. David Bowie and Hang On To Yourself. I have to declare an interest here. When Paul Morley was writing for the New Musical Express in its late 1970s heyday, I used to skim past his four-page polemic treatise, you know, where he'd bung in references to sociology and political philosophy in what I felt was quite a random way. So I admit I did rather fear the worst when I was sent a review copy of The Age of Bowie, the new book from Paul Morley, on sale at, by the way, a whopping £16. I have to say, in my view, my prejudices were confirmed. It's very rare indeed in life for me to give up on a book, especially when the subject is close to my heart, as David Bowie. But after about 50 pages, I couldn't take any more of it. Morley says that he gave himself a 10-week deadline to write the book, and in my opinion, it shows. And also, a common thread with Paul Morley, the book is as much about Morley himself as it is about David Bowie, in some passages with breathtaking pomposity. I know you haven't read the book, Jules, but I did send you a lengthy extract.
You did?
What do you make of Paul Morley's style in The Age of Bowie?
Well, my experience of Paul Morley previously was that I bought a book that he wrote some years ago.
Oh, you poor thing.
I think it was called Words and Music, possibly. And it was about... whenever you talk about Paul Morley, you almost say, oh, I don't want this to sound pretentious, but it's Paul Morley, so it's probably going to. He wrote this book about the idea that it was sort of a journey through a musical landscape. Yes, I know, eye roll. And it was trying to connect two pieces of music. He was basically, it was called A Words of Music, A History of Pop in the Shape of a City. And it purports to chart the history of popular music. And his starting points are his two favourite pieces at the time of writing, which is Kylie Minogue's electro-pop song I Can't Get You Out of My Head and Alvin Lucia's experimental I Am Sitting in a Room.
Oh, God.
I know. And it says its style takes the form of a robotic Kylie Minogue travelling with Morley in a cybercar towards a city of sound and ideas. So I read that, and this came out in 2005, and I think I read it at university not long after it came out. And at the time, I was rather dazzled by it. I thought it was very brainy. I thought it was very interesting. I thought there was lots going on. I read it about 4 years later and thought it was absolute garbage. And I think it probably says a lot about, you know, how I'd moved on, that when I was younger, you know, one wants to be very clever and very intellectual. And then you get a bit older and you just think, oh, you know, the diving's on in a minute with Claire Balding. I'd rather watch that instead. And in a way, I admire Paul Morley for trying to do something different and for at least trying to... I mean, I find The Enemy... We've talked about The Enemy previously, the relaunched Enemy, and how there seems to be very little in the way of content in it. And sometimes when you read reporting, I find that some of the NME's style of reporting now is beginning to teeter towards smash hits, except without any of the wit and invention, just as this kind of almost Fern Cotton-esque, to bring her up again, the kind of, you know, sort of breathless gush, really. So I actually admire Paul Morley for trying to do something a bit more intelligent with the form. But having said that, I find writers like Simon Reynolds to be far softer, to be far more fleet-footed in writing about these things, and to be far less, as you say, it's the pomposity of it that kind of gets me a bit. He gets it really right sometimes, and sometimes I find Paul Morley's writing really interesting, and in a way I can't help but admire the fact that, you know, he has the kind of the courage to get it wrong, if you see what I mean, although perhaps Paul Morley doesn't feel he has got it wrong, and that's you know, perhaps also instructive, I don't know. But yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? It's I kind of want to like Paul Morley's writing, and I can't seem to, at times, I find that more of a struggle than others, if you see what I mean.
So I certainly do. On the broader front, I mean, obviously this is his PN to, you know, the glory of David Bowie and so on. I find it most peculiar how we deify pop stars. I'm a huge fan of David Bowie. I have been for decades.
As am I, yeah.
Absolutely. As a very young teen, in fact, I was in the audience for the famous last Ziggy performance at Hammersmith
Odeon. I've heard about this before. Yeah, it's incredible.
But I can't get on with the school of thought that raises Bowie, Kate Bush, Jagger, Harry Styles, whoever, to the status of rock gods. You know, being able to...
When will Paul Morley write about Harry Styles? That's what I want to know.
Only a matter of time, I fear.
That's a book I'd read.
But being able to write and perform, you know, catchy pop songs, it's great. But that's all it is. Great performers, memorable songs that, you know, they may stay with us, maybe even influence our lives. But in terms of Bowie, yes, comedian, Corinthian and caricature, yes he is. But why do we escalate somebody like David Bowie to godlike?
I don't know, but actually, I think, again, I have slightly more patience for that than you do, I think, because I mean, both of us, music forms an enormous part of both of our lives, I think, doesn't
hugely.
It? But I find it really interesting, the point to which music shapes the culture of the nation as well. And I think that I can't explain why it is, but it feels to me like music seems to tap into our national psyche more than anything else does. I don't know if that's because music is my interest, so I kind of end up, I'm more attuned to that sort of thing. But I think that music, pop music in Britain, I don't know, over the years and different sorts of, you know, different artists and that sort of thing, seems to find a way into people's lives and not a lot of other culture always does necessarily. And I don't know. I think to be able to touch that many lives at once in such a profound way. I mean, the outpouring of grief when David Bowie died this sounds very strange, but the only other public outpouring of grief that I've seen that really kind of matched it was it wasn't quite Diana levels, but it was starting to go that way, I think, at times. And I found that really interesting, and the idea that he's managed to. So, I mean, I was just thinking, actually, in terms of sort of music touching the nation, I would thoroughly recommend Stuart McConey's The People's Songs, The Story of Modern Britain in 50 Records. There was a radio programme, and he's done a book to touch into that. And that had lots of, just rather than talking heads, just lots of ordinary people talking about sort of music and records and times in their lives. So I have a lot more sympathy for the idea of people that manage to kind of soundtrack a nation's lives. Maybe, yes, I wouldn't quite treat them as gods, but maybe they do deserve some kind of exalted status.
But,
yes, perhaps.
But Jules, the matter of his death, very sad, David Bowie's death earlier this year, very sad, but that's a matter for his family. Of course we can feel, oh, you know, that's awful, it's terrible, and, you know, perhaps even think, oh, you know, how it's affected us and so on. But the real emotional aspect of his death is for his family and perhaps his close friends. So lighting candles next to a mural in Brixton and laying flowers all over, that's bizarre behaviour.
I mean, it is, although having said that, I'm becoming increasingly impatient I'm becoming increasingly uncomfortable with the idea that it's up to me to judge what people's behaviour I think is accepted and what it isn't, really. Yes, perhaps it is a bit peculiar, but equally, if people want to do that, if people feel an emotional connection with his music and therefore perhaps with a lesser extent to him, although I do accept obviously they don't know him, his family does.
I think that's my point, yes.
Yeah, I know, but if people do feel that emotional connection, I mean, it's also interesting that David Bowie was still producing records, so it wasn't like he was some sort of long forgotten kind of, you know, artist that wasn't producing records anymore, and you know, everyone kind of suddenly thought, oh, what a shame, we've forgotten it. I'm being sad because I feel guilty about having forgotten about David Bowie. He was still very current. I mean, his most recent record has been nominated for the Mercury Music Prize. I suspect it, you know, that his death has had
I didn't like to say, but I suspect an enormous factor.
Although having said that, it is still an excellent record and certainly the best of Bowie's later period records, I think, and there is a certain chance and it might win. But so, I mean, I don't know, I have more sympathy with people expressing themselves in this way, I think, because I can understand. I'm not just saying it's because I admire David Bowie hugely, but because, you know, if you know, I think it's good that people have a cultural hinterland. I'd much rather that people were getting extremely upset about, you know, sort of people that had touched their lives sort of in a musical and cultural way than, for example, you know, becoming overly hung up with the performances of young people in Chelsea on reality shows or whatever. I think if people have the need to have something that is a sort of a cultural hinterland, you know, I welcome that in a way. So actually, I don't really mind. I think it's all right.
if you've got a view on this or anything else we've talked about, or indeed just want to contact us generally, the best way to do so is on Twitter, at SuperJules84 for Juliet, at Sir Terence for me. Always welcome hearing what you've got to say.
Jules,
I seem to remember you last week saying that you've got a lot of public appearances coming up.
Well, yes, that's not this weekend, that's next weekend. But yes, I will continue to build it up to fever pitch, although the wedding that we were playing is not a public appearance, sadly. I have bought a new suit, which may make an appearance.
They'll have to put they'll have to put security on the doors then if it's a private event to keep people away.
It's overzealous fans of mine.
Exactly.
I am saying this while smiling in case people can't pick up my irony here. In terms of radio appearances, we've got the Saturday Social this evening. Hooray! So that's M in our A to Z, I think. So that's from 6 to 7 p.m. on Saturday the 13th of August on barricaderadio.com. And also Indie Wonderland is back next Wednesday as well. I don't know if we'll be able to squeeze a third week out of Olympic theme songs, but we can at least try. That's 8 to 10 p.m. barricaderadio.com.
Cairn Gorm's wide thanks to Rona.
Absolutely, yes.
Thanks to you for listening. We're back next week. What are we closing with this week, Jules?
This funny little curio that I just dug up the other day. We've talked recently about Spotify, haven't we?
Yes.
Spotify discovery. I saw you and our friend Joe talking about your life-changing sort of ways in which you can cheat your Spotify.
Oh, yes, to stop. Well, yes, because sometimes I've never listened to a Queen track, for example, on Spotify, or indeed any Queen track through choice, I think, for probably 40 years. But occasionally, you know, something like that pops up in my Spotify discovery list, and I thought, oh, no, you know, how can I swerve this? And then I learned that by queuing the tracks that you do want, then you can just pluck out the tracks that appeal to you and you can avoid any Queen-like trauma, yes.
Yeah, that is excellent work. Mm. Well, this came up on my Spotify discovery this week, and it was a particularly good week, Spotify discovery this week. Well done, Spotify. I had lots of quirky instrumentals, and I think because of my repeated love of Spanish Flea, I now get thrown all sorts of bizarre things.
Ah, that's what it is, yeah.
And actually, this came from Supergrass's album, Road to Rouen, which came out, I think, in 2005.
What a great name. What a great title.
I know. And they recorded it in Rouen. But it's a fantastic name. And it's a rather short and slightly unusual album. They'd had some quite sort of large things happen to them, in that the drummer became embroiled in various tabloid scandals to do with wife swapping and whatnot.
Oh, Lord.
It was the Primrose Hill set,
Kate Moss
and all that kind of stuff. Yes. And at the same time, Gaz Coombs and his brother Rob, who's basically the sort of fourth member of Supergrass and plays keyboards, their mother died, I think, and so they were going through some quite large things as a band. And so they made this rather loose and quite fun album out in France, and this is a funny little instrumental. When I played it on Indie Wonderland earlier in the week, someone got in touch after I'd said who it was and said I would never ever have guessed this was Supergrass.
Yeah,
it sounds
different. Me too, yeah.
But and also I it often gets played as backing music on documentaries and things, those kind of Channel 4 real life. It almost sounds like something you'd hear on Life of Grime, doesn't it, as kind of backing music. I know Life of Grime's not on Channel 4, fact fangs, but you know what I mean. It's kind of documentary type music, but I just think it's a fun little tune. I assumed it was a cover, actually. I didn't realise it was an original, but it is. So this is Supergrass, and from Road to Rouen, this is Coffee in the Pot. We'll be right back.
You have been listening to a DACM Media production.